Because what are you doing? I'm going to be a Christian in Hollywood. Those are often the worst people in the world. Why? Because they lie to themselves about why they're doing what they're doing. You just like movies like everyone else. You know, like, that's nice. You think it's sexy. Like, don't lie to me. That if you're going to be a professional, this is something you really want to do because you have a vision of what you want to accomplish.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Marlo Slaback and Tom Sarouf.
And we're very excited to be joined today by Dr. Matthew Peterson, who's currently the editor-in-chief of The Blaze. But Matt, you've been involved in all sorts of things throughout your career. So instead of me introing that, how about you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? And of course, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be on. I'm glad we could make it work. Grateful to be here. It's a big, wide, woolly world. And if I do anything today, I'd like to encourage anyone listening, all the ISI young achievers, that, you know, there's a lot of different things you can do. And it doesn't mean your education ends. In fact, it just goes, we need a lot of Renaissance men and women out there. I guess just three things for me quick is academia. I thought I was going to teach right around the time when things really started to collapse. My wife reminds me it wasn't insane to go become a professor then. It actually sort of kind of made sense. You might, but it rapidly did not. There's not much you can do to change the educational system as a professor, unfortunately. So I taught American government, political philosophy, media because of things I was doing on the side. And I was also political consulting. I was analyzing the flow of power and money in some of the 88 cities in LA County, which was a red pill, as the kids say, about the form of government that was established there. So there was always the stuff I do for money with media and kind of consulting work. And I stayed in academia for a while and poked around, but I sort of realized that there's only so much I could do. You wouldn't be in charge. I wouldn't be in charge or be able to restructure things as a professor. Not that there's anything wrong with being a professor at all. It's noble, and we need more of those people, but we need them in institutions that don't hate us. So I finally reached the end of the rope there, and I thought, well, I'm just going to go make as much money as I can. It's against my ethos, but I have a family, and I've been teaching for a while, and I haven't really cared about that sort of thing. And it was right around that time when I was still doing, you know, stuff for money on the side, when Ryan Williams called me up and he's like, come back to the Claremont Institute. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to go back. Drag me back in. But he convinced me that they really wanted to do things. And it was an exciting time to be alive after Trump was elected. So, I mean, I don't know. He convinced me he wanted to do stuff, and he was true to his word. We revamped the fellowship programs. Claremont Institute fellowship programs are great stuff. And we also did a lot behind the scenes to further what we think is good. Within a week, I think, of being there, I was bowling in the White House and people were, you know, listening to what we were saying, which was different than the academic world. And also created something called the American Mind, which gotten a lot of, what do they call it in the left? Like good trouble? It's good trouble. We got a lot of good trouble. More of an elite publication, but didn't have huge numbers, but it had very influential numbers and had a lot of fun doing that. And then I finally did go back private sector in 2020 to a venture firm that was looking to build what we needed in politics and in media, finance, and tech, getting out in front of a lot of the people who are in finance who just aren't as political, don't have as sharp a vision, or aren't as insane as I am. And that was very interesting. As part of that, I ended up selling two media assets, some media stuff we had created, to Blaze, and then becoming editor-in-chief here at Blaze of a top five media company on the right. So I hope that made sense, but that's where I'm at now.
Hey there, listener. I wanted to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission here at ISI is educating for liberty. If you'd like to join us in fulfilling our mission, consider helping us by rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to help us reach more listeners like yourself. Now, back to the show.
So, tell us what it's like to be at the helm of a major news outlet, especially a conservative one with a pretty conservative audience in the current media atmosphere after. And me and Tom, just for listener knowledge, know Matt through Claremont's Publius Fellowship, which I'm not sure if the deadline has already passed for Poobs to apply, but if you have the opportunity and you're a student listening or a young professional or recent grad, I highly recommend that fellowship. I think me and Tom would agree it was a life-changing one, and Matt was, you know, an indispensable part of that. So the media atmosphere is obviously very charged, and we have an election, for those who don't know, later this year. What's it like being at the helm of such a media ship right now?
It's great because I feel like, I'm sorry, that's probably my laptop beeping and there's nothing I can do about it right now. But we just have to all deal with it. We're going to bear with it. I will tell you this, it is great because it is, the place to be, right? It's a key place to be this year. So in terms of positioning, it's right exactly where I certainly want to be, at least for the next 9 months. I want to be here longer than that, but I'm saying like this is the time. It's a historic year, and I don't think it looks good. So it's a very rare opportunity to reform and rebuild a media company that can survive what's coming this year, and that takes people into the future of what should be and what's possible, you know, given the situation we're in. So in other words, censorship regime is going to increase this year. I see nothing to stop it. It's going to be even worse than it was in 2020 in most ways. And there's some exceptions to that, right? X, Twitter, but it's mostly going to be bad. And so you know, you got to navigate that. And then the media landscape, right? If you look at what's going on just business-wise, I mean, it's falling apart. There's enormous companies just falling apart. They're just disintegrating all around. So it's very exciting. And that, in terms of that, it's exactly where I want to be. But it's also a serious, serious challenge because you can't just walk in and start, you know, beep, 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 moving the buttons and making everything go. Where Blaze is a very great place. It's a smaller company in terms of, you know, like Fox. But it's larger than a lot of the little conservative, like nonprofit world or whatever. And we have a lot to do. We have a real serious job here to reform and rebuild in a way that's non-destructive and that evolves the brand and evolves what we're doing. So it's kind of like a race, you know. So in that respect, it's very challenging. It's very hard. Like we have to figure out how to build behind scenes and stuff you can't see so it doesn't fall apart in the next 9 months, like I think other conservative media companies might. So that's really challenging and difficult. And look, no one on the right has built something that can just expand in media, that can just add content and grow and grow and grow. No one's built that apparatus yet. And that's what we have to do. But there's a reason no one's built it. And that's because it's really hard to do.
Right. And what do you think this is something I'm interested in, because as you mentioned lately, I think like Vice has hollowed out their staff. I think they completely collapsed the website or something. There have been a number of publications recently that have fired like a lot of staff. And obviously these are publications that are on the left, or the mainstream legacy, whatever they're called now. And conservative media is, I guess one of my critiques of it is it often seems that it's playing defense more than offense and, you know, kind of fighting back against the narratives that a lot of these media companies, and whether it's the New York Times or, it's Vice, whatever it is that they're setting. What do you think, as someone who is a visionary and kind of, you know, leading the Blaze through the kind of collapsing atmosphere that the left is up against right now, the media atmosphere, what do you think that the Blaze can do? And what do you think conservative media can do better to maybe set itself apart and survive some of those trends that are affecting journalists and larger media companies on the left?
Oh, wow. Well, if I'm successful, I can write a book on this later on. But, I think, let me start with attitude. sort of force of will. I think there's a real insecurity on the right in media. There's a lot of people who basically have failed careers in Hollywood or media, and so they're there on the right. And that, I think that is sort of pathological. Like, it plays into a lot of insecure sort of action, which means you start to act in extreme ways, or despise sort of actual aesthetics and beauty. Like, oh, well, you know, anyone can do that or whatever. So the upshot of it is you get the right thinking that we can't get the talent. This is a fundamental, like, I refuse this premise. Like, this is death to me. I assume, and I've always assumed throughout my career, that I can get anyone I want to work for me. Because if they see a vision that they agree with, right, and that they see that this is going to be the opportunity that it is, then they will want to work with us. And, you know, I think that that's very different, though, than the way people on right have operated, especially in creative spaces. And in the past, you know, there's good reason for that. In the past, it just seemed impossible. Now, I mean, there are tons of talented people. You have to pay them close to market rates, and they have to see that there's competence, which there's often not, in executive sort of leadership, you know, on the right. And that's what's unique about this opportunity at Blaze. We have a chance to build that, because it's not true that you can't get the talent. You can. Everyone hates what's going on. There's a lot of people who, guess what, you know, lean right, or whatever you want to call it. They're against the madness. But in the past, like, they see incompetence, they'd see weird insecurity and ego, and they would see a very, very small paycheck and say, like, why would I do that to myself? I'll just quietly work within the industry I'm in. And this goes, it's not just media, this goes to all sectors, right? But I think that's changing now, because people see the opportunity to build something new, and they also see how bad it is, right, within media itself. And so I don't just sense this. I know this. I've talked to people across the, it's amazing what's going on. And so you have to at least have the confidence that to say, no, we can get the talent. But the second part of this is, the reason you'll get the talent is if you have a vision of what you want to do. So if you don't understand what you're trying to do or accomplish in a positive way, then, you know, you're not going to get the talent. You're not going to get anything. You don't deserve anything. Because what are you doing? I'm going to be a Christian in Hollywood. Those are often the worst people in the world. Why? Because they lie to themselves about why they're doing what they're doing. You just like movies like everyone else. You know, like, that's nice. You think it's sexy. Like, don't lie to me. Now, if you're going to be a professional, this is something you really want to do because you have a vision of what you want to accomplish. And the right doesn't, you know, needs that positive vision of what it wants to accomplish.
Matt, I'd be curious to hear, I mean, a lot of media today focuses on the election cycle or sort of playing the day-to-day politics, like tons of commentators talking about what they're seeing on the news or responding to current events. But something I notice at The Blaze is one, there are others too, but like, for just one example, I love Orrin McIntyre, who you guys have picked up in the last like year or two. And he's not really covering necessarily day-to-day stuff, or if he is, he's tying it back to like a more worldview and enculturation and certain, I guess he'd call it dissident right or like neo-reactionary ideas and writers. But I'm wondering what you just, that's just one example of a tendency or a propensity that I think you understand of how media serves to educate the populace in this current paradigm of the media landscape and educational landscape. I'm just wondering if you could speak more to that for the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I mean, first off, let me say as a caveat, like, my own vision is not fully executed, throughout even the news or anything else yet at Blaze. I mean, we have to evolve. We have to gain the muscles to get to where I want to go. That's a process. So everywhere I look, I see work to be done, even though it's an amazing place, amazing company. But in my own, you know, day to day, I just see work that I need to do in order for us to get where we need to go. And I feel like we can get there. We all want to get there, but there's just grunt work to get there. So to your point, like, yes, what does that mean about the news cycle? Well, everything online, right, tends, as we know, towards getting the clicks. Now, the truth is the clicks are important. It's a metric of power. But if you're moving to subscription model, as we have, it's less important. It's more important that you get subscriptions and you have engaged followers. And to that point that you make, I think it's very important and very fascinating. In a way, it's logical, like my progression career-wise, because I wanted to educate and reform like what the idea of the university is.
Right.
Right. And that was impossible in the actual universities. But where can you really teach in mass now? Well, it's with media, because the most interesting ideas are people sitting around like, this Oren guy is exciting. You know, what's he saying? And people are willing to spend hours listening. These are their actual professors, right? So, and it's not just younger people. I mean, I'm talking 55-year-old hedge fund managers, right, who are just looking for signs of life. That was the American mind. There were some older folks around Claremont who said, oh, you're going to ruin our reputation and you're publishing these suits. And, you know, this must be kids in their mom's basement listening and talking to each other. And the truth is, no, a lot of them are incredibly wealthy, successful people who are looking for a shred of non-platitudinous signs of life. And that is what the opportunity is right now. So there's a lot of educational sort of content that you can put out there. And then also, I think there's a way to even get a little bit more, you know, newsy, but just more in depth, to give people more like 10-minute blocks in a daily news show that I hope will appear in a few months if I don't have a heart attack first. 10-minute blocks that go a little bit more in depth in the interviews rather than your usual like a few minutes, even on like Tucker Carlson Tonight. If you're a guest, you got, you know, this much time. Well, let's get a little more time. Let's do a little bit deeper, but let's still move, right? And I feel like people want that depth. They're starving for it.
Do you see that with younger demographics as well? Something that I constantly hear in the ISI, you know, orbit is the kids are being educated by YouTube University and TikTok University, right? And I think that's true to a certain degree. And that the short, you know, tidbits and clips are affecting their ability to perform in the class, in like actual standard classrooms. How do you see that affecting the media environment of the future and adapting to those preferences for, you know, Zoomers who are, you know, more interested in like just perpetual scrolling of these, you know, like curated clips and rather than like substantive media? Like, I don't know if like do these long form, oftentimes really well-written reported pieces from like the New Yorker, will they appeal to a changing media environment? Or what are your thoughts on just how to appeal to, you know, obviously a lot of ISI's audience is undergraduate students. And so their preferences are perhaps much different than that older demographic that would perhaps appreciate this more, you know, the deep dives, the substantive reporting and material.
Yeah, so this is important. Let me first say something a little positive about the reels and the feed and whatever. And that's this, you know, we used to have something and we still do, and there's millions of boomers watching it every day, called cable, right? And cable is just streaming, right? I mean, you don't get to fast forward until you did when digital came in, right? So there's a sense in which like the going to the streaming stuff, the poison of it is that it's short, right? And over time, the screens are definitely rotting our brains. So I predict behavior will change. Elite slash in sense of excellence behavior will increase this whole like anti-screen thing for kids. Students in college will reject cell phones at increasing rates, even though it's a minority. There's going to be a lot more of them because it's going to, like, the data when this comes out, which is already there, this is worse than smoking. It's worse than, I mean, it's like people will not have executive brain function for the rest of their lives if they're just been on screens for the first 20 years of their life. I mean, it's unbelievably damaging. And so there'll be more acknowledgement of that. And as that happens, you'll get almost like a more medieval situation where some people will be even more in depth and very intellectual, right? They'll be they'll know three or four different languages and whatever, and be like scribes. And then you're going to, you know, unfortunately have a mass of people who are just addicted to this stuff. But my first comment is, I don't think like having streaming content is, that's TV too, right? So I think that the goal is, what is that streaming content? And, you know, what are you learning from there? And I think there's a lot that can be done there. Like there's a ton that can be done that is of interest to people who have some part of themselves that's not just swept away by the tide of addiction, distraction, and whatever. So you're going to have some island in your life if you're interested in, you know, based PragerU or whatever you want to call it. But you're going to have some island in your life that drives that interest in what's in depth. So there's that. Okay. Backing off that, I'll counter myself again. There's something else here that's interesting, which is that right now there are millions of people who want the deep dive and want that long form stuff. So some of the most popular stuff since I've come to Blaze was actually our investigative piece on Tim Ballard, a guy who was on the right. And these women came to us and we decided to, in this case, actually investigate someone on the right, because we thought these were valid concerns. And also he had raised a bunch of money with, you know, Glenn Beck and Blaze over the years. So we felt like we owed it to our audience to investigate him. And those two pieces have like record numbers for engagement on the website. So it's simply not the, like, people were interested in that long report. And I feel like there's millions of people like that. So we haven't tapped out that market at all.
I'd also be interested in, you were kind of mentioning about how, I guess, elites are excellent people, potential leaders and statesmen, which is something that we're thinking a lot about in terms of at ISI, in terms of helping form and acculturate the next leadership class in America.
I heard someone wrote a book there recently about statesmanship.
That's right, Johnny's book. And so as we think about that sort of thing, I'm wondering, and I know you've, like, your PhD is in classical political philosophy, and you think a lot about the American founding, the American founders, these great leaders and statesmen. And so I'm wondering, I guess, how your interests or your background in classical political philosophy, statesmanship, translates into how you think or approach leading this media company, and not just the media company in your own personal role, but how leadership and statesmanship intersect with these sorts of things.
Well, I think they do. And if they don't, what are we even doing?
Right.
I would encourage everyone listening to think about the way in which the role of statesman applies now, in a time where everything is politicized, and in a time in which I think we face some very, very real challenges. How your role as statesman is not defined by actually being a statesman. In other words, if you know some of these politicians, or most of them, the vast majority of them, even the ones I like, right? There are very, very few who would you even put in that category. Most of them are extremely unimpressive people. Tucker Carlson is, you know, most right about this. And so where are the people who are actually acting for the sake of the common good? Well, they damn well better be in an oligarchical society or an aristocracy even as well. Like, they better be other places, right? And they better be in business. They better be in nonprofit world. There better be people who are acting in statesmanlike ways. People should realize that that's not just a term that should apply now to people who are elected officials in politics. And if that is the case, then we're sunk. Now, eventually, you want some of those people to possibly be in that position, but you can influence a lot outside of it. And I firmly believe that the only way that good happens in the world is that, first off, everything's falling apart. Everything's always going to hell in a handbasket in human existence. And that's human nature. That's every society. Everything's always going to hell in a handbasket. The only way that things go right is that every once in a while, a few good people sacrifice a lot, whether anyone realizes it or not, and get the job done. And that just helps the thing to creak on, you know, to hurtle on and survive without falling into barbarism. And so I think that that's the case now. So then the one particular thing I'd say is that one of the characteristics of statesmanship or prudence is realizing that one has to quietly work over time to do what needs to be done, whether other people realize it or not. So, you know, a lot of the work of prudence is quietly seeing the opportunities to stitch things together or to build things. And it's not going to be apparent to anyone else. And it's not something you're going to like reveal your plan to the world all the time, right? It's something you quiet, it's a quiet, it's often a quiet work. And you have to have some interior place where you really have thought deeply and worked hard and done a lot to figure out, I think it needs to, the ship needs to move in this direction. And I got to get the ship to move in this direction. And in order to do that, it's not like lying or weird, you know, Machiavellian evil. It's just in order to do that a lot of times, you know, it's not going to be apparent to everyone. You're not going to lay out your whole, you got to quietly work, right, at those opportunities. And that's what great statesmen do. And it, that can be done in every sector of American life right now.
Great insight. Thanks, Matt.
What do you think the, do you think the incentives for just from a very, I guess, superficial and materialist way of analyzing the types of personalities and people who are attracted to public service and, you know, roles of, we'll call them, you know, servants who are in strictly political roles, whether that's, you know, your House of Representatives or a senator or whatever. Do you think that over time, and you're saying, you know, everything's always going to hell in a handbasket. We do live in a fallen world, so I appreciate that. But do you think that there's anything in particular today that, like I know a lot of people, myself included, I almost have this reflexive skepticism towards anyone who's attracted to power today. I mean, you look around at the types of personalities that are drawn to running for office, and it's, you know, oftentimes like there's scandal. You're totally skeptical of them. Of course, there's a lot of baggage. And I've been reading a number of different biographies about people like, you know, like Blessed Karl of Austria. And there is a degree of, you know, almost kind of denying your own self. And obviously the incentives were different. It's the Habsburg Empire. So it kind of came with the family name. And that's different in a democratic republic. But what would you say are... obviously Tucker offers a good assessment of this all, but what's your own thoughts on where should people who have a disposition for leadership or maybe the instincts that go into good statesmanship, should they be going into these positions of you know, public office, whether that's like at the local or even national level, or are they better serving constituents and others in the private sector, in nonprofit environments, or, you know, totally like, even if it's like serving on your public school board, where should those people be going right now? Or do you still have hope in, you know, these people who are maybe students right now who are still seeking out potentially running for some sort of office that they should continue to do that? Or will their impact be better elsewhere?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let me first agree with the problem. I mean, the problem is that a lot of the people who go into this now, when I say unimpressive, I mean that even these are people who would sell out their country for, you know, an extra like tens of thousands of dollars or enough money to like buy a vacation house and have a small boat in the Chesapeake that they use on the weekends. And they want the pinnacle of success is a McMansion in McLean, Virginia. And then, you know, they want to have an affair with the intern or something like this. Even their vices are small, you know, I mean, it's like at least they're small souled individuals, and it's pathetic, really. It's disgusting to me. It's revolting to me, the kind of DC consultant class, you know, petty tyrants. They don't want enough, you know, it's like they're small souled people. So, you know, there's a lot of politicians like that where it's like my buddy, I don't know if I should mention his name. My buddy, he's an actor. He likes to say when he meets people like, yes, I'm an actor. It means there's something wrong with me. I didn't get a lot of attention from my father. He wasn't around. So I pretend to be other people in front of a camera. And that is hilarious, right? And completely disarming and self-knowledge. But that's pretty much all politicians too. right? And so there's always that nagging. So in terms of leadership, I mean, I think it's really hard. I think you have to know something about what virtue is and what statesmanship is. And, you know, I know prominent people in tech give virtue talks who aren't even religious, right? Why? Because they know that people, like, no one's been taught this. That's okay, right? You haven't, it's not your fault. You haven't been taught what virtue is, what it means to develop the habits that make you strong, that make you a leader. And, you know, like Washington, the more that you're self-possessed, the more that you control yourself, as hard a truth it is for all of us to think about, the more people are actually drawn to you because they can sense that you can control yourself and they see some kind of quality in you that they want to follow, whether or not you're good or bad. You can do good or bad with that, with these virtues sometimes. So anyway, I think you have to first know what virtue is and then see how you would have to work on these things over time. You have to have some sense of how you would progress spiritually or, you know, and emotionally and in all these ways. And then, so you'd have to know something about that regardless of where you go, right? And then I would say you would want to find, you know, you're young and ambitious for the right reasons because you're going to use power for good, not like those other guys. Then you'd want to get in a situation where you could sort of prove to yourself and other people that you can lead other people. And usually that means getting your, you know what, handed to you and starting out at the bottom of somewhere and working your way up and demonstrating some kind of skill in any kind of sector. So I don't think it really matters. I think as long as you demonstrate success truly in any of these things that outside of politics, I feel like that would be very, very important for most people. If you were in politics, then I want to see that you can actually lead people, right? So that being said, I think everyone should be involved in their local community right now. If you're a decent person, you should absolutely be doing your school board stuff. You should be doing all that stuff. And who knows where it leads, right? You don't even have to. That's how a lot of people get involved in politics. They get pissed off at something locally. This is a classic American story. And then they conquer. So everyone should be involved in some way. But I think if you're young and you're thinking about this, you should be trying to demonstrate success in leadership in other sectors before you go into politics. Because being a politician is a lot like being, I mean, sadly, it's like a little secret here. It's like being a professor or a media star. And the problem is if that's all you've done, you have a problem in leadership because your job is sort of a Jedi master job, right? Where you're kind of like, ideally, people leave you alone and you do your stuff and you get better at things with your peers intellectually. But it's kind of like you're out there yourself and you're not expected to like lead large teams of people, right? So those aren't things that for long periods of time would lead to the kind of leadership we're talking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Matt, I know you've got a hard stop in a couple minutes. So I have a two-part question to, I think, wrap things up. I guess the first part of that is I'm wondering, you look through history, whether it's American history or the history of the West or just world history more generally, and I'm wondering where you think we are right now. And then related to that, I had a professor at Boston College, great lady, great mentor, who always talked about, you know, doing the next right thing. And sort of the tie into prudence is seeing what that is, seeing what that opportunity is, like you said earlier, and then being able to do that effectively and grow in that virtue. So this might be a hard sort of second part related to sort of seeing where we are. But in terms of getting to being in a place to do the next right thing, what is your, I guess, general life advice? And that might be a little bit hard because students are doing all sorts of different things, but some general broad themes of, you know, what is some things that people can do to prepare them or even see the opportunities of doing the next right thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it's very difficult to say, you know, where you are at any given time and place and zoom out and say like, well, we're in this period and this is what will happen next. But I do think that regardless of how I categorize things or see things, I mean, what am I most sure of? I'm most sure that the next right thing to do is to foster a commercial cultural movement, as I call it, that is, because culture is made by commerce in America. It's what, I mean, I like that as, you know, creative. I don't like it, but I like to be more artsy, but culture is made by commerce in America. So it needs to be cultural and commercial. And that will, I think, that needs to be done. Why? Because you have to unify everyone who's on Team Sanity. You have to get billions of dollars. Without the money, you know, you got nothing. You got to get billions of dollars out from under woke capital, and it's all been hijacked by the other side. So that, and you have people killing themselves, you know, suicide, actual suicide, but also, you know, health, food, just all the degeneracy. This society is killing itself. And the commercial cultural apparatus is like pushing all this on the people. So the only way to fly, regardless of what happens to America, to unify everyone who's just on the other side. Some people are, they're not on the right. They're not religious. They're just about human excellence. And they see that this stuff is crazy. Maybe more like an Elon. Some people are, you know, Christian, religious in some way. They're against what's going on. Some people are on the right. There's some people who are more like Joe Rogan listeners who are sort of like, I don't know, this stuff is kind of weird. I'd rather be with these people. Everyone who wants to live in the same neighborhood needs to actually live in the same neighborhood now. And this is the only way to save the whole. If you're going to save the whole, if there is a saving of the whole, you have to bring together this coalition of people in a real visceral way. So I think there's 1,000 things that can be done if you understand that, because that means that there's all kinds of new companies that need to be created where you're trying to use technology to help people and not crush them and destroy them and dehumanize them. That means that you're going to have to push, you know, all kinds of best practices that we haven't thought about, you know, how to use technology, for instance. And that means that you're going to have to come up with new rhetorical ways to argue for an attractive way of life that is truly attractive, that is truly true, good, and beautiful, that should sell itself, right? So where is your advertisements for a way of life that is worthy of the name in the 21st century for America? I don't know what the American way of life is at this point, but that's our job to determine what it is in this next century. And that means, you know, how do I live my life? Ways of life. And that's why I say commercial cultural. What do I buy and why, right? How do I actually live my day-to-day life? How do I see the point of a job and family, et cetera, right? All those basic things need to be like reconstituted for people. So I think that the sort of unity that would come from that, from, you know, living in the same neighborhood and buying products and services from each other, and creating art and culture together, like that's what needs to be done. And that's what everyone can participate in.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Matt. If people want to follow more of your work, or if you have things that you would suggest our listeners to go find or go look for, what would you commend to them?
If you're interested in anything I said, I wrote a piece called The Way Forward for the American Mind a while back. It lays out some of this vision. Particularly about how media is essential in order to put together anything that I just described. So you can find that in American Mind if you look up Matthew Peterson, and I think it's The Way Forward, Path Forward, something like that. I'm unfortunately on Twitter. You'll know that I've reached a certain number in my head income-wise, but I'm not, because I won't have to be anymore. But until then, poor man that I am, I'm on Twitter at DOCMJP. And then, of course, Blaze Media. You need to help us build. It's only $3 a month if you can do it. And you can, if you do that, I guarantee that that money will be used to build something that is going to blow people's minds over the next year.
Sweet. Well, we'll plug all of that in our show notes. Thanks again, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this episode, be sure to check out our website at isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, debates, lectures, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.